They headed in the two planes south toward Hellas. Passing over Tarina Mohol next to Hadraica Patera, they landed briefly. The Mohol town was punctured and needed help to start the rebuilding. There were no robots on hand, but Nadia had found she could start an operation with as small a seed as her programs, a computer, and an air miner. That kind of spontaneous generation of machinery was another aspect of their power. It was slower, no doubt of that. Still, within a month, these three components together would have conjured obedient beasts out of the sand. First the factories, then the assembly plants, then the construction robots themselves, vehicles as big and articulated as a city block, doing their work in their absence. It really was confounding, their new power. And yet all of it was as nothing in the face of human destructiveness. The five travelers flew from ruin to ruin, becoming numb to the damage and to the dead. Not that they were insensible to their own danger. After passing over a number of wrecked planes in the Hellas Elysium flight corridor, they switched to night flights. These were more dangerous than day flights in many ways, but Yelly was more comfortable with their level of stealth. The 16Ds were nearly invisible to radar and would leave only the faintest traces on the most powerful tight-focus IR detectors. All of them were willing to take the risk of that minute exposure. Nadia didn't care at all. She would have been happy to fly by day. She lived in the moment as much as she could, but her thoughts ran in circles as she kept trying to drag them back to the moment. Stunned by the waste of all that had been destroyed, she was becoming far distanced from her emotions. She only wanted to work. And Anne, some part of Nadia noticed, was worse. Of course, she must have been worried about Peter. And then all the destruction as well. For Anne, it was not the structures, but the land itself, the floods, the mass wasting, the snow, the radiation. And she had no work to distract her. Her work would have been the study of the damage, and so she did nothing, or tried to help Nadia when she could, moving around like an automaton. Day after day they worked at initiating the repair of one ruined structure or another, a bridge, a pipeline, a well, a power station, a piste, a town. They lived in what Yelly called Waldo World, ordering robots about as if they were slave masters or magicians or gods, and the machines went to work trying to reverse the film of time and make broken things fly back together. With the luxury of haste, they could be sloppy, and it was incredible how fast they could initiate construction and then fly on. "In the beginning was the word," Simon said wearily one evening, punching at his wrist pad. A bridge crane swung across the setting sun. And then they were off again. They started up containment and burial programs for three blown reactors, staying safely over the horizon and working by teleoperation. While watching the operations, Yelly sometimes switched channels and had a look at the news. Once the shot was from orbit, a full disk shot of the Tharsis hemisphere, in daytime for all but the western limb. From that height they could see no sign of the outflows, but the voiceover claimed they had occurred in all the old outflow channels that ran north from Marineris into Chrysi, and the image jumped to a telescopic shot which showed whitish-pink bands in that region. Canals at last, of a sort. Nadia snapped the TV back to their work. So much destroyed, so many people killed, people who might have lived 1,000 years, and, of course, no word of Arkady. It had been 20 days now. People were saying he might have been forced into complete hiding to avoid being killed by a strike from orbit. But Nadia no longer believed this, except in moments of extreme desire and pain. The two emotions surging up through the obsessive work mode in a brand new mixture, a new feeling that she hated and feared. Desire causing pain, pain causing desire. A hot, fierce desire that things not be as they were. How painful such a desire was. But if she worked hard enough, there was no time for it, no time to think or feel. They flew over the bridge spanning Harmakis Vallis on the eastern border of Hellas. It was down. Repair robots were cached in end houses on all major bridges, and these could be adapted to total reconstruction of the spans, although they would be slow at it. The travelers got them going, and that evening, after finishing the last programs, they sat down to microwaved spaghetti in the plane's cabins, and Yelly turned on the Terran TV channel again. There was nothing but static and a snaking, destroyed image. He tried switching channels, but all the channels were the same. Dense, buzzing static. "Have they blown up Earth, too?" Anne said. "No, no," Yelly said. "Someone's jamming it. The sun is between us and it these days, and you would only have to interfere with a few relay satellites to cut contact." They stared glumly at the fizzing screen. In recent days, the local aerosynchronous communications satellites had been going down left and right, shut down or sabotaged, it was impossible to say. Now, without the Terran news, they would really be in the dark. Surface-to-surface radio was limited indeed, given the tight horizons and the lack of an ionosphere, not much more range than Walker intercoms, really. Yelly tried a variety of stochastic resonance patterns to see if he could cut through the jamming. The signals were scrambled beyond repair. He gave up with a grunt, punched out a search program. The radio oscillated up and down through the hertz, gathering static and stopping at the occasional faint punctuation, coded clicking, irretrievable snatches of music. Ghost voices gabbling in unrecognizable languages, as if Yelly had succeeded where SETI had failed, and finally, now that it was pointless, gotten messages from the stars. Probably just stuff from the asteroid miners. In any case, incomprehensible, useless. They were alone on the face of Mars, 5 people in 2 small airplanes. It was a new and very peculiar sensation, which only became more acute in the days that followed, when it didn't go away and they understood that they were going to have to proceed with all their TVs and radios blanked by white noise. It was an experience unique not only in their Martian experience, but in their whole lives. And they quickly found that losing the electronic information net was like losing one of their senses. Nadia kept glancing down at her wrist pad, on which, until this breakdown, Arkady could have appeared any second, on which any of the first 100 might have showed up and declared themselves safe, and then she would look up from the little blank square at the land around her, suddenly so much bigger and wilder and emptier than it had ever been before. It was frightening, truly. Nothing but jagged rust hills for as far as the eye could see, even when flying in the airplanes at dawn and looking for one of the little landing strips marked on the map, which, when spotted, would resemble little tan pencils. Such a big world. And they were alone in it. Even navigation could no longer be taken for granted, no longer be left to the computers. They had to use road transponders and dead reckoning and visual fixes, peering down anxiously in the dawn twilight to spot the next airstrip in the wilderness. Once it took them well into the morning to find a strip near Dal Vallis. After that, Yelly began to follow pistes, flying low through the night and watching the silvery ribbon snake below them through the starlight, checking transponder signals against the maps. And so they managed to fly down in the broad lowland of Hellas Basin, following the piece to Low Point Lakefront. Then, in the horizontal red light and long shadows of sunrise, a sea of shattered ice came over the horizon into view. It filled the whole western part of Hellas. A sea. The piece they had been following ran right into ice. The frozen shoreline was a jagged tangle of ice plates that were black or red or white, or even blue, or a rich jade green, all piled together as if a tidal wave had crushed Big Man's butterfly collection and left it strewn over a barren beach. Beyond it, the frozen sea stretched right over the horizon. After many seconds' silence, Anne said, "They must have broken the Hell's Pontus aquifer. That was a really big one, and it would drain down to Low Point." "So the Hellas Mohole must be flooded," Yelly said. "That's right. and the water at the bottom of it will heat up, probably hot enough to keep the surface of the lake from freezing. Hard to say. The air is cold, but with the turbulence there might be a clear spot. If not, then right under the surface it will be liquid for sure. Must be some strong convection currents, in fact. But the surface, Yelly said. We'll see pretty soon. We're going to fly over it.
We should be landing, Nadia observed.
Well, we will when we can. Besides, things seem to be calming down a bit.
That's just a function of being cut off from news.
As it turned out, they had to fly all the way across the lake and land on the other side. It was an eerie morning, flying low across a shattered surface reminiscent of the Arctic Sea, except here the ice floes were frosting like an open freezer door, and they were colored across the whole spectrum. Heavy on the reds, of course, but this only made the occasional blues and greens and yellows stand out more vividly, the focus points of an immense, chaotic mosaic. And there at its center, where, even flying as high as they were, the ice sea still extended to the horizon in every direction, there was an enormous steam cloud rising thousands of meters into the air. Circling this cloud cautiously, they saw that the ice underneath it was broken into bergs and floes, floating tight-packed in roiling, steaming black water. The dirty bergs rotated, collided, turned turtle, and caused thick walls of red-black water to splash upward. When these walls fell back down, waves expanded out in concentric circles, bobbing all the bergs up and down as they passed. There was silence in the two planes as they stared down at this most un-Martian spectacle. Finally, after two mute circumnavigations of the steam column, they flew on westward over the shattered waste.
Sax must be loving this revolution, Nadia said as she had before, breaking the silence. Do you think he's part of it?
I doubt it, Anne said. He probably wouldn't risk his Terran investment, nor an orderly progression to the project or some kind of control. But I'm sure he's evaluating it in terms of how it affects the terraforming. Not who's dying or what's getting wrecked or who's taking over here, just how it affects the project.
An interesting experiment, Nadia said.
But hard to model, Anne said. They both had to laugh. Speak of the devil. They landed west of the new sea, lakefront was drowned, and spent the day resting. And the next night, as they followed the piste northwest toward Marineris, they flew over a transponder that was blinking SOS in Morse code. They circled the transponder until dawn and landed on the piste itself, just beyond a disabled rover. And next to it was Sax, in a walker, fiddling with the transponder to send his manual SOS. Sax climbed into their plane and slowly took off his helmet, blinking and purse-mouthed, his usual bland self. Tired, but looking like the rat that ate the canary, as Anne said to Nadia later, he said little. He had been stuck on the piste in the rover for 3 days, unable to move. The piste was dead, and his rover had no emergency fuel. Lakefront had indeed drowned.
I was leaving for Cairo, he said, to meet with Frank and Maya, because they think it would help to have the whole First Hundred together, to form some kind of authority to negotiate with the Unoma police and get them to stop.
He had taken off and was in the Hellespontus foothills when the low point Mohol's thermal cloud had suddenly turned yellow and plumed 20,000 meters into the sky. It turned into a mushroom cloud like a nuclear explosion, but with a smaller cap, he noted. The temperature gradient isn't so steep in our atmosphere. After that, he had turned back and gone to the edge of the basin to see some of the flooding. The water running down the basin from the north had been black, but kept going white, icing over in big segments almost instantaneously, except around lakefront where it had bubbled, like water on the stove. Thermodynamics were pretty complex there for a while, but the water cooled the mohole pretty fast and...
Shut up, Sax, Anne said.
Sax lifted his eyebrows and went to work improving the plane's radio receiver. They flew on, six of them now.
Sasha and Yelly, Anne and Simon, Nadia and Sax. 6 of the first 100 gathered together as if by magnetism. There was a lot to talk about that night, and they exchanged stories, information, rumors, speculations. But Sax could add little concrete to the overall picture. He had been cut off from the news just as they had been. Again, Nadia shuddered as if at a lost sense, realizing that this was a problem that wasn't going to go away. The next morning at sunrise, they landed at Bockhuysen's airstrip and were met by a dozen people carrying police stun guns. This little crowd kept their gun barrels down, but escorted the 6 with very little ceremony into the hangar inside the crater wall. There were more people in the hangar, and the crowd grew all the time. Eventually, there were about 50 of them, about 30 of them women. They were perfectly polite and, when they discovered the travelers' identities, even friendly. "We just have to make sure who we're dealing with," one of them said. "And who are you?" Nadia asked boldly. "We're from Korolyov Prime," she said. "We escaped." They took the travelers into their dining hall and treated them to a big breakfast. When they were all seated, people took up magnesium jugs and reached across the table to pour their neighbors apple juice, and their neighbors did likewise, until everyone was served. Then, over pancakes, the two groups exchanged stories. The Bockhuysen crowd had escaped from Korolyov Prime in the first day of the revolt, and had made their way this far south, with plans to go all the way down to the southern polar region. "That's a big rebel location," the woman told them. "There are these stupendous bench terraces with overhangs, you see, so in effect they're these long open-sided caves, a couple clicks long most of the time, and quite wide, really. Perfect for staying out of satellite view, but having a bit of air. A kind of a Cro-Magnon cliff-dweller life they're setting up down there. Lovely, really." Apparently, these long caves had been famous in Korolyov, and a lot of the prisoners had agreed to rendezvous there if a breakout ever occurred. "So are you with Arkady?" Nadia asked. "Who?" It turned out they were followers of the biologist Schnelling, who from the sound of it had been a kind of red mystic held in Korolyov with them, where he had died a few years before. He had given wrist lectures that had been very popular on Tharsis, and after his incarceration, many of the prisoners in Korolyov had become his students. Apparently, he taught them a kind of Martian communalism based on principles of the local biochemistry. The group at Bockhuysen wasn't very clear about it, but now they were out and hoping to contact other rebel forces. They had succeeded in establishing contact with a stealth satellite programmed to operate in directed microbursts. They had also managed briefly to monitor a channel being used by security forces on Phobos. So they had a little news. Phobos, they said, was being used as a surveillance and attack station by transnational and Unoma police forces, recently arrived on the latest continuous shuttle. These same forces had control of the elevator, of Pavonis Mons, and of most of the rest of Tharsis. The Olympus Mons Observatory had rebelled, but been firestormed from orbit, and transnational security forces had occupied most of the Great Escarpment, effectively cutting the planet in two. And the war on Earth appeared to be continuing, although they had the impression it was hottest in Africa, Spain, and the U.S.-Mexican border. They thought it was useless to try going to Pavonis. "They'll either lock you up or kill you," as Sonya put it. But when the 6 travelers decided to try anyway, they were given precise directions to a refuge a night's flight to the west. It was the Southern Margaritifer weather station, the Bockhuysen people told them, occupied by Bogdanovists. Nadia's heart leaped when she heard that word. She couldn't help it. But Arkady had a lot of friends and followers, and none of them seemed to know where he was. Still, she found herself unable to sleep that day, her stomach again tied in a knot. That night at sunset, she was happy to return to the planes and take off. The rebels in Bockhuysen sent them on their way so laden with hydrazine and gases and freeze-dried food that their planes had a hard time getting off the ground. Their night flights had taken on a strangely ritual aspect, as if they were in the process of inventing a new and exhausting pilgrimage. The two planes were so light that they were buffeted hard by the prevailing western winds, sometimes bouncing wildly 10 meters up or down, so that it was impossible to sleep for long, even when one wasn't flying. A sudden drop or lift, and one was awake again in the dark little cabin, staring out the window at the black sky and stars above, or the starless black world below. They spoke hardly at all. The pilots hunched forward, expending their energy on keeping a visual fix on the other plane. The planes hummed along, winds keening over their long, flexible wings. It was 60 degrees below zero outside, the air only 150 millibars and poisonous, and there was no shelter on the black planet below, for many kilometers in every direction. Nadia would pilot for a while, then move to the back and twist and turn and try to sleep. Often the click of a transponder over the radio, combined with the general aspect of their situation, would remind her of the time she and Arkady had ridden the storm in the Arrowhead. She would see him then, striding red-bearded and naked through the broken interior of the dirigible, tearing away paneling to throw overboard, laughing, fines floating in a nimbus around him. Then the 16D would jerk her awake, and she would twist with the discomfort of her fear. It would have helped to pilot again, but Yelly wanted to as much as she, at least for the first couple of hours of his watch. There was nothing for it but to help him watch for the other plane, always a kilometer to the right if all was well. They had occasional radio contact with the other plane, but microbursted the calls and kept them to a minimum, hourly checks or inquiries if one fell behind. In the dead of night, it sometimes seemed this was all any of them had ever done. It was hard to recall what life had been like before the revolt. And what had it been? 24 days? 3 weeks, though it felt like 5 years. And then the sky would begin to bleed behind them, high cirrus clouds turning purple, rust, crimson, lavender, and then swiftly to metal shavings in a rosy sky. And the incredible fountain of the sun would pour over some rocky rim or scarp, and they would search anxiously as they ghosted over the pocked and shadowed landscape, looking for some sign of an airstrip by the piste. After the eternal night, it seemed impossible that they would have navigated successfully to anything at all, but there lay the gleaming piste below, which they could land on directly in an emergency. And the transponders, being all individually identifiable and pegged to the map, their navigation was always more sure than it seemed. So every dawn they would spot a strip down in the shadows ahead, a welcome blonde pencil strip of perfect flatness. Down they would glide, thump against the ground, slow down, taxi to whatever facilities they could find, stop the engines, slump back in the seats. Feel the strange lack of vibration, the stillness of another day. That morning, they landed at the strip by the Margaritifer station and were met at their planes by a dozen men and women who were extravagantly enthusiastic in their welcome, hugging and kissing the six travelers countless times and laughing as they did so. The six clumped together, more alarmed by this than by the wary greeting of the day before. Their welcomers didn't neglect to run laser readers over their wrists to identify them, which was reassuring. But when the AI confirmed that they were indeed receiving 6 of the first 100, they burst into cheers and carried on in the very highest of spirits. In fact, when the 6 were led through a lock into a commons, several of their hosts went over immediately to some small tanks and breathed in hits of what proved to be nitrous oxygen and a pandorphin aerosol, after which they laughed themselves silly. One of them, a slender, fresh-faced American, introduced himself. "I'm Steve. I trained with Arkady on Phobos in 12 and worked with him on Clark. Most of us here worked with him on Clark. We were in Schiaparelli when the revolution began." "Do you know where Arkady is?" Nadia asked. "Last we heard, he was in Carr, but now he's out of the net, which is the way it should be. A tall, skinny American shambled up to Nadia and put his hand on her shoulder and said, "We're not always like this," and laughed.
"We're not," Steve agreed, "but it's a holiday today. You haven't heard?"
A giggling woman scraped her face off the table and cried, "Independence Day, 14, the 14th!
"Watch, watch this," Steve said, and pointed at their TV.
An image of space flickered onto the screen, and suddenly the whole group was yelling and cheering. They had locked onto a coded channel from Clark, Steve explained, and though they couldn't decode its messages, they had used it as a beacon to aim their station's optical telescope. The image from the telescope had been transferred onto the Commons TV, and there it was, the black sky and the stars blocked at the center by the shape they had all learned to recognize, the squared-off metallic asteroid with the cable extending out of it.
"Now watch," they yelled at the puzzled travelers. "Watch!"
They howled again, and some of them began a ragged countdown, starting at 100. Some of them were inhaling helium as well as nitrous oxide, and these stood below the big screen singing,
"We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz, because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. We're off to see the wizard."
Nadia found herself shivering. The shouted countdown got louder and louder, reached a shrieked 0. A gap appeared between the asteroid and the cable. Clark disappeared from the screen instantly. The cable, gossamer among the stars, dropped out of view almost as fast. Wild cheers filled the room, for a moment at least, but it caught as if on a hitch as some of the celebrants were distracted by Anne leaping to her feet, both fists at her mouth.
"He's sure to be down by now," Simon cried to Anne over the din. "He's sure to be down. It's been weeks since he called."
Slowly, it got quiet. Nadia found herself at Anne's side, across from Simon and Sasha. She didn't know what to say. Anne was rigid, and her eyes bugged out horribly.
"How did you break the cable?" Sax asked.
"Well, the cable's pretty much unbreakable," Steve replied.
"You broke the cable?" Yelly exclaimed.
"Well, no, we separated the cable from Clark, is what we did. But the effect is the same. That cable is on its way down."
The group cheered again, somewhat more weakly. Steve explained to the travelers over the noise,
"The cable itself was pretty much impervious, its graphite whisker with a diamond sponge mesh gel double helixed into it, and they've got smart pebble defense stations every 100 kilometers, and security on the cars that was intense, so Arcadi suggested we work on Clark itself. See, the cable goes right through the rock to the factories in the interior, and the actual end of it was physically as well as magnetically bonded to the rock of the asteroid. But we landed with a bunch of our robots in a shipment of stuff from orbit and dug into the interior and placed thermal bombs outside the cable casing and around the magnetic generator. Then today we set them all off at once, and the rock went liquid at the same time the magnets were interrupted. And you know, Clark is going like a bullet, so it slipped right off the cable end, just like that. And we timed it so that it's going directly away from the sun, and 24 degrees out of the plane of the ecliptic as well. So it'll be damned hard to track it down. At least we hope so."
"And the cable itself?" Sasha said. It got loud with cheers again, and it was Sax who answered her in the next quiet moment.
"Falling," he said. He was at a computer console, typing as fast as he could, but Steve called out to him.
"We have the figures on the descent if you want them. It's pretty complex, a lot of partial differential equations."
"I know," Sax said.
"I can't believe it," said Simon.
He still had his hands on Anne's arm, and he looked around at the revelers, his face grim. "The impact's going to kill a lot of people."
"Probably not," one of them replied, "and those it does kill will mostly be UN police who have been using the elevator to get down and kill people here on the ground."
"He's probably been down a week or two," Simon repeated emphatically to Anne, who was now white-faced.
"Maybe," she said.
Some people heard this and quieted down, Others didn't want to hear and continued to celebrate. "We didn't know," Steve said to Anne and Simon. His expression of triumph was gone. He was frowning with concern.
"If we had known, I guess we could have tried to contact him, but we didn't know. I'm sorry. Hopefully..."
He swallowed.
"Hopefully he wasn't up there."
Anne walked back to their table, sat down. Simon hovered anxiously at her side. Neither of them appeared to have heard anything Steve had said. Radio traffic increased somewhat as those in control of the remaining communications satellites got the news about the cable. Some of the celebrating rebels got busy monitoring and recording these messages. Others continued to party. Sax was still absorbed by the equations on the screen. "Going east," he remarked.
"That's right," Steve said. "It'll make a big bow in the middle at first, as the lower part pulls down, and then the rest will follow."
"How fast?"
"That's hard to say, but we think about 4 hours for the first time around, and then an hour for the second time around."
"Second time around," Sax said.
"Well, you know, the cable is 37,000 kilometers long, and the circumference at the equator is 21,000, so it'll go around almost twice."
"The people on the equator had better move fast," Sax said.
"Not exactly the equator," Steve said. "The Phobos oscillation will cause it to swerve away from the equator to a certain extent. That's actually the hardest part to calculate, because it depends where the cable was in its oscillation when it began to fall."
"North or south?"
"We should know in the next couple of hours."
The six travelers stared helplessly at the screen. It was quiet for the first time since their arrival. The screen showed nothing but stars. No vantage point existed from which to view the elevator's fall. The cable, never visible for more than a fraction of its length to any single observer, would stay invisible to the end, or visible only as a falling line of fire.
"So much for Phyllis's bridge," Nadia said.
"So much for Phyllis," said Sax. The Margaritifer group re-established contact with the satellite transmissions they had located, and they found they were also able to poach a number of security satellites. From all these channels, they were able to piece together a partial account of the cable's fall. From Nicosia, a Unoma team reported that the cable had fallen north of them, crumpling down vertically while yet still rapidly covering ground as if it were cutting through the turning planet. Though north of them, they thought it was south of the equator. A staticky, panicky voice from Sheffield asked them for confirmation of this. The cable had already fallen across half the city and a line of tents east of it, all the way down the slope of Pavonis Mons and across East Tharsis, flattening a zone 10 kilometers wide with its sonic boom. It would have been worse, but the air was so thin at that elevation that it didn't carry much force. Now the survivors in Sheffield wanted to know whether to run south to escape the next wrapping or try to get around the caldera to the north. They got no reply, but more escapees from Karlyov, on the south rim of Melis Kasma in Marineris, reported over one of the rebel channels that the cable was now falling so hard it was shattering on impact. Half an hour later, an Orium drilling operation called in. They had gone out after the sonic booms and found a mound of glowing, brecciated debris stretching from horizon to horizon. There was an hour's absence of any new hard information. Nothing but questions and speculation and rumor. Then one of the headphoned listeners leaned back and showed thumbs up to the rest of them and clicked on the intercom, and an excited voice came on, yelling through the static,
"It's exploding! It came down in about 4 seconds. It was burning top to bottom, and when it hit the ground, everything jumped right under our feet. We're having trouble with a leak here. We figure we're about 18 kilometers south of where it hit, and we're 25 south of the equator, so you should be able to calculate the rest of the wrap from that, I hope. It was burning from top to bottom, like this white line cutting the sky in half. I've never seen anything like it. I've still got after images in my vision. They're bright green. It was like a shooting star had stretched. Wait, Jorge is on the intercom. He's out there and saying it's only about 3 meters high where he is. It's soft regolith here, so the cable's in a trench it smashed for itself. He says it's so deep in places you could bury it and have a level surface.
Those'll be like Fords, he says, because in other places it stands 5 or 6 meters high. I guess it'll do that for hundreds of kilometers at a stretch. It'll be like the Great Wall of China.
Then a call came in from Escalante Crater, which was right on the equator. They had evacuated immediately on news of the break with Clark, but had gone south so that the arrival of the cable had turned out to be a close thing. The cable was now exploding on impact, they reported, and sending sheets of molten ejecta into the sky, lava-esque fireworks that arced up into their dawn twilight and were dim and black by the time they fell back to the surface. During all this time, Sachs never left his screen, and now he was muttering through pursed lips as he typed and read. The second time around, the speed of the fall would accelerate to 21,000 kilometers an hour, he said, almost 6 kilometers a second, so that for anyone within sight of it, a dangerous place to be, deadly if you were not up on a prominence and many kilometers away, it would look like a kind of meteor strike and cross from horizon to horizon in less than a second. Sonic booms to follow. Let's go out and have a look, Steve suggested with a guilty glance at Anne and Simon. A lot of them suited up and went outside. The travelers contented themselves with a video image piped in from the exterior camera, alternating that with video clips gleaned from the satellites. Clips shot from the nightside surface were spectacular. They showed a blazing curved line cutting down like the edge of a white scythe that was trying to chop the planet in two. Even so, they found it hard to concentrate, hard to focus on what they were seeing and understand it, much less feel anything about it. They had been exhausted when they had landed, and now they were even more exhausted, and yet it was impossible to sleep. More and more video clips were being passed along, some from robot cameras flying in drones on the dayside, showing a blackened, steaming swathe of desolation. The regolith blasted to the side in two long parallel ejecta dikes, banking a canal full of blackness, black all studded with a brecciated mix of stuff which got more exotic as the impact became more severe, until finally a drone camera sent along a clip of a horizon-to-horizon trench of what Sack said must be rough black diamonds. The impact in the last half hour of the fall was so strong that everything far to north and south was flattened. People were saying that no one close enough actually to see the cable hit survived it, and most of the drone cameras had been smashed as well. For the final thousands of kilometers of the fall, there were no witnesses. A late clip came in from the west side of Tharsis, from the second pass up that great slope. It was brief but powerful. A white blaze in the sky and an explosion running up the west side of the volcano. Another shot from a robot in West Sheffield showed the cable blasting by just to the south. Then an earthquake or sonic blast struck, and the whole rim district of Sheffield fell off the rim in a mass, dropping slowly to the caldera floor 5 kilometers below. After that, there were any number of video clips bouncing around the fragmented system, but they proved to be only repeats or late arrivals or film of the aftermath. And then the satellites began to shut down again. It had been 5 hours since the fall began. The 6 travelers slumped in their chairs, watching or not watching the TV, too tired to feel anything, too tired to think. Well, Sack said, now we've got an equator just like the one I thought the Earth had when I was 4 years old. A big black line running right around the planet. Anne glared at Sack so bitterly that Nadia worried she would get up and hit him, but none of them moved. The images on the TV flickered, and the speakers hissed and crackled.